I'm going to also acknowledge a number of the officials who are deeply involved in this negotiation in the room, and in particular my very close friend and professional colleague for over 30 years, Dr. Adrian Mason, our climate change ambassador. And for those who actually want to find out what's going on, you should walk out of the room now and go and listen to Adrian tomorrow in the IPS, because you'll be able to contradict everything that I'm saying. We can't just look at the international negotiation in isolation. We must look at it in a broader context. And I've got a few headings here, some of which I'm going to develop a little bit, others I'm not. We have to look at it in the context of what the science is telling us. We have to look at it in the context of what international public opinion is telling us. And we have to look at it in terms of what domestic policy measures, what's the big picture as we survey domestic policy measures for climate change. And then we can turn to the international negotiating framework. Now, the reason why I insist on this is because negotiators have a tendency to think they live in this deeply sophisticated world that is not actually joined to the common people and their concerns. And there is a wonderful quotation that I wrote down 30 years ago, which I have here, from Lord Keynes. It's in the introduction to one of the best books I've ever read in my life, by Dr. Richard Gardner, called Sterling Dollar Diplomacy in the Post-War World. And Keynes, this is quite a complex quotation, so let me just explain. What he's doing is talking about the same issue. He's talking about the world of the professional insiders and their sense of superiority and the outside world. And what he said is this, and this of course was during the 1940s, when they were setting up the superstructure of the post-war order. For there are, in the present age, two opinions. Not the true and the false, but the opinion of the outsiders and the opinion of the insiders. Those who live in limited elite circles and share the inside opinion pay both too much and too little opinion, attention to the outside opinion. Too much, because ready in words and promises, think communique language, to concede to outside opinion everything. Too little, because they believe that these promises are so certainly designed to change that it is tiresome to analyze their literal meaning and consequences. Nevertheless, this is the crucial point that Keynes was making. What is said before the world is still of deeper consequence than the subterranean breathings and well-informed whisperings, knowledge of which allows inside opinion to feel superior to outside opinion, even at the moment of bowing to it. Very powerful. What is he saying? Listen to the voice of the outside world and professional negotiators. Now, when I went to my first ever climate change meeting in Poznan, it was, I think, the worst international economic meeting that I have ever been to. But I had to struggle before making that choice, because I've been to hundreds of international economic meetings. And right up there, competing with Poznan for the title of the worst. You have to understand that I'm looking at this through the eyes of somebody who has no experience on climate change, but a lot of experience on international economic negotiations. And I struggled as to whether it was the worst, because there was another strong competitor, the Heysel Centre Conference in Brussels, 1990. So the Punta del Este roadmap, ring a bell, the word roadmap? The Punta del Este roadmap agreed in 1986 to launch the Uruguay round of trade negotiations, had agreed that they would be completed on the 1st of August 1990. And I have persuaded a very angry Jim Bolger, who's been Prime Minister for 6 days, to come up to the House of Senate conference in Brussels, because we're going to conclude the Uruguay round. And I remember I was sitting next to a gentleman that I still have a lot to do with. His name is Crawford Fulton. He's now Deputy Secretary in fact. And Crawford is sitting next to me as the 27th Minister of Trade gets up to say that I'm here to conclude the Uruguay round in accordance with the Punta del Este roadmap. And Crawford whispers to me, "What are these people saying? I'm still waiting for the negotiation to begin." And he was right. The negotiation after 4 years had not begun. Oh yes, there had been endless meetings, I unfortunately was between most of them, but it hadn't begun. So I guess the lesson here is, be careful in assuming that solemnly agreed roadmaps, because of the political commitment from the highest level, necessarily means a very much. And I can be 100% certain that the Bali roadmap has got to be rewritten. There's not one chance in a thousand of reaching agreement in Copenhagen on what one very, very prominent person was saying on the podium when I first walked into my first ever climate change meeting, that we will have in place in Copenhagen a full and ratifiable treaty. There's not one chance in 8,000 for that happening. Now, I went from Poznan to Geneva because world leaders had also concluded at the G20 summit that they were going to conclude not the Uruguay round, but the Doha round. And they instructed their trade ministers to go to Geneva to do this. And astonishingly, their trade ministers didn't even turn up, let alone do the job. And there's a variety of complicated reasons I could use to explain why that is possible in international diplomacy. Except one, me. I turned up. And I turned up because I wanted to see what the hell was going on here. So I wanted to meet Pascal Ami, Ambassador Crawford Faulkner, who replaced me as chairman of the WTO agricultural negotiations when I decided to join the dark side and go to politics. And I had six at his dinner table, previously my dinner table in Geneva. I had six of the world's greatest minds on international trade negotiations. And I'd taken a list of climate change acronyms to the dinner table. Now these people like, two of them are former senior negotiators, lead negotiators in the country, now Deputy Director General of the WTO. The role of professional trade negotiations is the most closely aligned profession in the world to international climate change. So I gave them an exam test. And I gave them the following acronyms. LULUCF. What does that mean? I said, it's not a British pop star from the 1960s. But none of them knew that. I said, RED. Another clue. This is not a British pop star from the early 1990s. It's not that simple. RED? No, we don't know what that means. How about Quail Rose? AWGKP versus AWGLCA? No. MIB? Anyone know what MIB is? All right, what about NAMA? Now, at that point, they looked at me strangely and said, well, come on, Tim, we all know what NAMA means. It's the residual tariffs from HS 2007 to Appendix 1 of the AOA. No, but amongst professional negotiators, you don't need to translate this. You can talk in code and everyone understands. I knew exactly what they meant. What it means is the list of tariff items that is the first appendix to the Uruguay Round Agreement on Agriculture that defines from HS 207, which is the Harmonized Tariff System of 2007, those tariffs that are to be treated as agriculture. The residual of Appendix A is non-agriculture, and NAMA for WTO negotiators means non-agriculture market access. And I said, you're all wrong. That's not what it means in climate change. It means nationally appropriate mitigation actions. And before you ask me what that is, don't tempt me, because I've got in my bag here a piece of paper, and have I got a template for you? So the problem is that this incomprehensible negotiation is going on while public opinion demands action. and this possibility of tears. In terms of my sense of the evolution of international opinion, we have moved decisively beyond the situation that allowed the US Senate to reject the Kyoto Protocol 95-0. I'm extremely concerned about that underlying issue as to what type of treaty obligation could get through the US Senate. And I'll come to that in a moment. But I believe it is clear that public opinion, going back to my point about Keynes, demands a solution. No matter what happens in Copenhagen, and if it got even worse after Copenhagen, because we clearly have to move on beyond Copenhagen, cannot possibly do this deal. Even if it got worse than that, I am absolutely convinced that public opinion internationally has moved decisively on this issue. There is no possibility for politicians in that disaster scenario to say, oh, well, we tried to fix climate change, didn't work, sorry about that, guys, let's move on. No chance at all. There is no chance in my professional lifetime, and I would hazard, if I were someone younger, I could still make that statement, of the international community walking away from climate change and the efforts to coordinate action internationally. Which I think is a very good thing to remember when you hear the next disappointment and you assess it as that's just hopeless and scale of the problem. And I say that not just with respect to developed countries. I think it's manifestly clear that developing countries, you can say that about developing countries. For those of you who are interested in a... Can you shut the door? For those of you who are interested in a highly readable account and who doubt that, read Thomas Friedman's latest book, Flat, Hot and Crowded. There's a wonderful passage about what's happening in China and climate change. It's quite encouraging, actually. There's no doubt in my mind, both from reading that book, listening to Chinese ministers and professional negotiators, that the Chinese get it. No doubt at all. I think they've got massive, massive problems in following the model of Kyoto, but nevertheless, they get it. They know that this is a real issue for China, not just a diplomatic issue. They have 24% of the world's people, 9% of the world's arable land, and problems on water that you wouldn't believe. Science, no real, I'm not going to talk about that. I believe that a responsible politician, whether they come from a tiny country like ours or a large country, has no choice. I understand the intellectual argument against the word consensus on science, but you know, for me, Arnold Schwarzenegger nailed it. He said, and you know, he's been, to his great credit, a leader, political leader. So he said, look, my son is sick. I consult 10 physicians. Mm-hmm. 9 of them say, take your son to the hospital. 1 says, look, there's nothing wrong with the boy. It'll fix itself. What do? I take my son to the hospital. Okay? I mean, that to me just nails it. I understand there are scientists and I don't question their qualifications or their integrity, who don't agree, who are still in the skeptic camp. But I think responsible politicians have to go with the consensus. And that means with the IPCC. No other choice. Now, I understand the political implications to be drawn on the left of this debate. You have to implement it as if it's some type of instruction, but politics will get in the way of that. But nevertheless, that's the fundamental starting point. Will the science change? I mean, one of the sillier aspects in terms of some bits of public opinion is the science is settled. I mean, you only have to read any IPCC report to know how silly that statement is, because there is massive uncertainty in the IPCC and they will list all the research that still needs to be done. But in the broad metaphorical sense of that phrase, we have to accept that science has decided this is something we need to do something about. And my sense from what I've been told by our scientists is that where the science moves in the future, it's likely to get in a sense, even worse.
Probably.
Well, wait a second. Probably even worse, meaning, you know, we're just not going to get there, guys, if we don't hurry up. Domestic policy. Again, before I get to the international. Very important. Yeah, I know targets were set on carbon dioxide. But, you know, it's, to me, coming as it from a professional trade negotiator's perspective, what's happened around the world is simply astonishing. I don't know what the people thought it was. A UN exercise? So they go out there and they negotiate this deal called the Kyoto Protocol for the first commitment period. They're given more than 10 years lead-in time, and they sit on their ass and do nothing, with one exception, one honorable exception, the EU. I mean, it's just incredible. What do they expect? It's to happen automatically. No attempt to introduce a domestic policy framework that might actually address the problem. Now, that mistake is now being corrected, but ludicrously late. New Zealand will be saved by pure serendipity. We thought we were going to have to pay a cheque or carry forward a cheque of a deficit of $1.5 billion, and through sheer luck, found that the satellites had underestimated sequestration. So we're going to get out of jail card free this time. But for those of you who are familiar with the likely projected pattern of harvesting in New Zealand, there is no get out of jail card for New Zealand in 2020. So nothing has been done, essentially, to attack gross emissions. The previous government of New Zealand introduced on the last day of Parliament with 870 last minute amendments, so please, its response. And forced it through. The Australians are struggling with this now, but it sounds like 2 days ago, Penny Wong, my Australian counterpart, which I share with Nick, who's in charge of the domestic side of this debate, managed to do a deal with Malcolm Turnbull, and it looks like the Australians will get this done. That must have been one negotiation, one mother of a negotiation, for those of you who understand the linkage between split opinion in the Liberal Party and the issue of double dissolution, but I could explain it, but I won't go there. But, this weekend, the Prime Minister is leading six of us across, six ministers across, meeting Kevin Rudd, and I'm sure over a few beers, as I watch very pessimistically the lettuce load cup in the afternoon function, I'll get a download on what that negotiation was actually like. It must have been brutal. So, but, you know, look, perhaps that's harsh. Perhaps it's just the way things work out. In the chaos of democracy, the process of, frankly, radically changing the fundamental basis of economic policy, which is what an ETS implies, long-term. I mean, long-term, the point about putting a price on carbon so that we can start the process of de-linking over the very long-term, the relentless growth of emissions from economic growth, because there'll never be a support, Pache Green Party, for not proceeding with economic growth. So we have to find a way of delinking it, or we're not going to do the job. Now that process in a democracy is always going to be messy, blood on the floor. You know, the Europeans are further ahead than anyone, all credit to them. I could say something bitchy, but I won't, about why it's so much easier for them. To do with the bubble, for those of you and outsourcing of their emissions, for those of you familiar with the technical base. But nevertheless, to their credit, they got 43% of their economy outside their price of carbon. But they've done something that nobody else has done. So all credit. The process in the US is inevitably messy. I don't know what will happen to the Waxman-Marcus bill. But, you know, democracy fixes these problems after, you know, wins its way around. We'll get a price on carbon introduced in the developed world in the next few years, including in this country. We are very close, I think, to getting a deal. We hope Labour will support the changes we want to introduce, but one way or other, we will get this done. in New Zealand. Well, actually, in New Zealand, we do technically have an NDS. It's actually in operation. It's a question of we're not comfortable with aspects of it, so we're seeking some amendments. Now, it's an iterative process. We won't get it right. Nobody will get it right. We'll have to make adjustments. People have to accept that, be adult about this. If any of you have trained as economists, you know what the phrase law of unintended effects means. Let me tell you this. If ever there's a case of public policy where the law of unintended effects applies, it applies here. We will make our best assessments, but finally, we will need to make adjustments in all manner of ways, including ramping it up, depending on what the science tells us and what the evolution of public opinion and what international efforts are. With developing countries' domestic policy, well, they're way back behind us. I think the consciousness is there. There's obvious signs in China of a early beginning towards renewables. But they are way back because of a fatal mistake. Well, fatal is too strong a word. It may prove fatal. A very serious mistake made by negotiators of Kyoto Protocol. And that leads me into the international framework. And I'll start with a very serious mistake. The problem, I think, is this, and this is quite brutal of me to say it, but I'm going to say it all the same, is I think most negotiators, with the important exception of the chief Australian negotiator, Meek McDonald, whom I know, who is a professional negotiator, thought it was a game about being nice to developing countries. They failed to understand the critical difference between the science-based nature of the problem on climate change and the GATT. I've written a speech on this, which I delivered in Bali, to a think tank I used to be a member of called the IPS Linux Planet, that's on the website. But broadly speaking, my view is this. Inside the GATT is a concept called special and differentiated treatment. And what it means is, in the field of international trade, is we don't expect developing countries to do so much. I mean, that's putting it terribly simple. You know, there's a whole lot of complexity around the enabling clause probably. But what it does not mean is we don't expect developing countries to do nothing. And it's also conditional on their level of economic response development, taking on full responsibilities, and it's not bound in law. So Kyoto negotiators simply transposed this, changed the name to common and differentiated responsibilities. And developing countries, apart from weak reporting functions, which are meaningless, and haven't been lived up to, have done nothing. Now this is a very, very serious mistake. And it's a very serious mistake for all manner of reasons. First of all, the developing countries have just tucked themselves in behind this hardline position, as you would expect, and refusing to cede any ground. Secondly, it's a fundamental mistake because the underlying nature of the problem in climate change is different from trade. In the field of trade, if you liberalise your own economy, anyone who studied Ricardo Hume knows this, and Jonathan, who's the developing world, says, well, I'm too poor, I don't want to do that. Is that a problem for me? No. I can liberalise my economy, and I will still strengthen my economy through normal competitive forces, even if he doesn't. Now, if he does a little bit, I get a bigger benefit. I get benefit from me, I get a benefit from he will strengthen his economy, and also open up new opportunities for me to export to Jonathan, otherwise known as Fred. If he liberalises more fully over a longer period of time, which is what how it's meant to work in the GATT, WTO, then everybody benefits. The problem in climate change is that none of us can fix this unilaterally, because a ton of CO2e going into the atmosphere does not distinguish the geographic source